The Battle for Liberty, Episode 28.
This is the Battle for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Battle for Liberty. Once again, I'm your host, Mike Tilden. Thanks so much for joining me. I would like to welcome you back to the podcast dedicated to the journey of the libertarian novice. Before we get started, I want to remind you, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. That really helps me out. If you could do me one better, you want to do me a favor? Find a friend and tell them about the show. Refer them over to the website, battleforliberty.com. Follow me on Twitter at @MyBattleLiberty. We're also on Gab at Battle for Liberty. You should like the Facebook page. That's facebook.com/battleforliberty. As always, if you want to reach me, you can email me at mike@battleforliberty.com, and we'll have a show notes page for this episode, and that will be battleforliberty.com/28. That's that one convenient location for all of the content that we're going to talk about on this episode. All right, well, welcome back after a long 2 to 3 week break, depending on how often you've been listening. We're back, and I want to apologize for the delay. You were probably expecting this episode to be released on its usual day. I know I was. That should have been Friday, February 17th, but I quickly found out that wasn't going to happen. And so I was hoping for a release on Monday or Tuesday, the 20th, maybe the 21st. But then circumstances conspired against me, and the delay just grew and grew. And I wanted to quickly just explain why I feel that you deserve that. So here's what happened. During the week that that episode was originally supposed to be released, my family received some news that my wife's grandfather was in very bad condition health-wise. Now, he was 90 years old, and he had been suffering from Alzheimer's for probably 5 years, maybe more. And recently his health had been failing. He was in and out of the hospital several times, and, you know, he wasn't really recognizing some of his own children at this point. Unfortunately, the Friday that this episode was supposed to be released, we heard that he had lost his battle and he passed away. So at 90 years old, the man had a wonderful life, but it was still very hard on my wife and her family, as you can imagine. He was a dedicated family man who had 5 children, 19 grandchildren, and 19 great-grandchildren. And my 2 children are 2 of his great-grandkids. So after we heard the news, you know, we decided pretty quickly that missing the funeral was not an option. Although we live halfway across the country and we don't get back to Pennsylvania very often, this was one of those times where it really just, there was no question we were going to go back for this. But we had never taken 2 young children on a flight across the country before. And we were in for a few surprises. First of which being that it takes a lot of logistics and a lot of planning in order to get your kids and everything your kids need all the way across the country in bags that an airline will check for you. You know, they have, diapers, and they have outdoor clothes and indoor clothes, and they need funeral clothes and different shoes, and they need their nighttime routine and their noisemakers, and, you know, there was a lot of logistics. So it took us the entire weekend to make arrangements, and then the funeral wound up being in the middle of the following week. And so we decided, since it's so expensive to take the entire family across the country, we decided, look, if we're going to go and it's going to be the middle of the week, I may as well take some vacation, and we're just going to turn it into a week-long trip. So that's what we did. We really wanted our kids to see their family that they haven't seen in quite some time. We have many family members in that area. It's the general Pittsburgh area. my brother and his family is there. My wife's family and all of her extended family are there. And, you know, my kids have about 1 million cousins in that area. A couple of them they haven't seen. And I have a niece and a nephew that I've never met up until that weekend. So we all decided, look, it's just going to be a vacation. It's weird to call it a vacation when a loved family member has died. But everyone understood what we meant. You know, it's not like we were happy that he died, but we may as well, you know, turn it into something good. We know that what a family man my wife's grandfather was, that's exactly what he would have wanted. So that's what we did. So in addition to all this, though, as if this wasn't complicated enough, in addition to all of this, about 3 or 4 days before the trip, my 3.5-year-old daughter decided, now is the time that she's ready to potty train. So throughout all of this, we've also been playing the transition from diapers and pull-ups to underwear. And we've been playing the game of run like a madman every time she says, I gotta pee. So that's what we've been doing. And I'm actually really proud of her. I mean, once she flipped the switch in her brain, she really hasn't had any accidents. She's been pretty good now for 2 or 3 weeks straight. Overnights, naps, everything. She's great. So with all of that said, I just wanted to explain to you why there was no way I could have gotten the episode out on time Friday morning of the week that it was supposed to be released. And then the subsequent vacation and time off. I took my microphone with me thinking that I might get some time away, but it didn't happen that way. There was a lot going on. And frankly, I would much rather have spent time with family that we don't get to see too often. So I know you get that. Most of you are family oriented people. So I know you understand, but I felt that I owed you at least an explanation. So that's why there's been such a long gap in the content. But that gap is now over. Here it is. We're here. Episode number 28. And if you are on my email list, then you already know what we're going to be talking about, or at least I gave you a pretty decent hint about what we were going to be talking about. If you're not on my email list, by the way, what is wrong with you? You need to be on that email list. So head on over to battleforliberty.com. Any single one of the pages on that site, at the very top, there's a black bar that says Join the Battle. Put your email address in the box, hit submit, and you will get notifications about when I can't put an episode out and why I can't put an episode out. See, all of my email subscribers, they were in the loop. They knew what was going on. And, you know, silly old you, not on my email list, you were sitting there thinking, oh man, another podcast that got through, you know, a couple dozen episodes and then decided to call it quits. No, that's not what happened. And if you'd have been on my email list, you would have known that. So don't find yourself in that predicament ever again. Go over to battleforliberty.com and sign up for the email list, and then you will always be in the know. So what are we going to be talking about in episode 28? Well, because this episode was designed to be released on or around President's Day, I had planned to talk about the worship of U.S. presidents. It turns out that the worship of U.S. presidents from U.S. history is almost universally required year-round, especially in public schools. Tom Woods has this great analogy where he says, you know, we don't think twice about how we revere and look up to U.S. presidents. But imagine for a second that Walmart ran the schools, and every day your kids had to stand up at the Walmart and face the Walmart flag and look at a wall with all of the Walmart CEO's pictures on it and pledge allegiance to Walmart and talk once a year on a specific CEO day. They'd talk about all of the wonderful things the CEOs have done. I mean, we would think that's creepy and deranged. And he's absolutely right. On President's Day in particular, we are forced to endure this yearly ritual of this creepy religion that worships the men who have held the office of chief executive of the general government. And it's on this day every year that I'm reminded of the person I consider to be the most inappropriate of American idols, and that would be Abraham Lincoln. So we are going to focus on Abraham Lincoln for this episode. Now, Lincoln is almost universally hailed as the greatest president in U.S. history. But I don't think of him that way. In fact, he's probably my most hated president. In today's traditional understanding of Lincoln, that statement that I hate Lincoln the most, that might be seen as incredibly odd or ignorant, or maybe even prejudiced and racist. That's typically the attack that you'll endure. But that's because most people are operating under what's been described as the Lincoln myth. You see, most people don't know the truth about Lincoln because our culture is so dedicated to the Lincoln myth. And so I've coined a new term. I call it LMS, the Lincoln Myth Syndrome. And I want to see in this episode if you're suffering from Lincoln Myth Syndrome. So when you think of Abraham Lincoln, what do you think of? What's the first thing that pops into your mind? Now, if you're like millions of Americans, your mind immediately jumps to this grandiose vision of the great emancipator, the man responsible for freeing the slaves. And when asked, many people will tell you that he was the greatest president because he fought a war to free the slaves. He was willing to do whatever it took for the cause of abolition. And so it's not shocking to find out that Lincoln is consistently ranked as either the best president in history or, in some rankings, he's second best, usually second to George Washington. Over the last 40 to 50 years, there have been about a dozen of these official presidential rankings, and when you look at them, you see that he's either number one or number two, consistently. So I don't think it's out of line to ask, well, what makes him so great? If it's just settled fact that he's the best, what makes him so great? I mean, did he really crusade to free the slaves? And if that were the case, then I might be willing to rank him pretty high myself. After all, as a libertarian, slavery is one of the worst examples of human bondage and the lack of respect for liberty. So, of course, as a libertarian, slavery is abhorrent to me. But it turns out that those fanciful notions just aren't true. See, Lincoln was never motivated by the abolition of slavery. But you would never know that because you probably have Lincoln myth syndrome. And it's okay, it's really not your fault. I mean, most people have this disease. So, what's another reason that most people love Lincoln? Well, the other primary reason you'll hear for why Lincoln was the greatest president is that he saved the Union during the Civil War. And now, this is a notion that is so shockingly ignorant of the structure and purpose of the Union itself that it finds no basis in history or fact. And in an effort to rid you of your Lincoln myth syndrome, we're going to cover that laughable falsehood as well. But before we continue further down this path, I want to give you a healthy dose of warning. Once you've decided that Lincoln myth syndrome is an affliction from which you would like to rid yourself, there's no going back. The undeniable truth is that at this point in our society, Lincoln is untouchable. He is beyond reproach in civil society. If you speak or write ill of Lincoln or his agenda, you will be attacked. It's not if it will happen, it's when it will happen. And I don't know if you're ready for that. Now, I know I am. So if you're ready for the cure, I say bring it on. I say let's examine Lincoln without falling prey to the inflated reputation that the mainstream mythology has given him. Why not, right? I mean, if the man was so great, then what is there to fear? If he was truly this near deity that he's been made into, then why should anyone fear a thoughtful examination of his life and his politics? Let's get into it. All right, so the Lincoln myth, let's start with this. So there have been more than 16,000 books written about Abraham Lincoln. And in the vast majority of those books, you will not hear a tale based in reality. You will hear mostly mythology. As I've said, Lincoln is almost universally considered to be the best president in U.S. history due to his crusade to abolish slavery and his crusade to save the Union. It's in that light that Lincoln's actions, which you'll soon learn, include waging an unprecedented style of total war against the sovereign peoples of the Confederate States. It includes jailing of his dissidents. It includes the deportation of U.S. citizens. It includes the suspension of habeas corpus. It includes the violent silencing of dissenting opinion. It includes the complete and total destruction of entire southern cities and the confiscation of private property and the installation of martial law in the South. It's in the light of the Great Emancipator that those actions are routinely excused. So if and when you get a reasonable person to admit that those actions, the ones that I've just described, are normally things that should be avoided, they'll immediately temper that admission by saying, well, but because he freed the slaves, then the ends justify the means. The means are excused. And what you'll discover is that this is the mythology speaking. Nothing in history supports the assertion that Lincoln waged war with any purpose of ending slavery. In fact, what you're going to learn over the next hour or so is that Lincoln's political motivations had nothing to do with ending slavery and everything to do with centralization and consolidation of power. That's a harsh truth to hear, and it is obscured by the Lincoln myth. So, how can I claim that Lincoln's motivations had more to do with consolidation than the abolition of slavery? Well, as is usually the case, in order to fully understand the complexities of this situation, you have to have a good grasp on the history and context of the time. Newsflash, it's quite a bit more complex than you might have been led to believe in your middle school and high school civics classes. So here's our agenda for today. I'm going to start by reviewing Lincoln's conception of the Union, because that's very important that we understand that. Then we're going to study what his primary political motivations were. And only at that point will we really be ready to fully understand how slavery fits into Lincoln's agenda. So we'll cover that after his political motivations. And then we'll finish up on what I and to a great extent, other learned men from whom I've learned a great deal, what they think Lincoln's true legacy really is. So are you ready? It's going to be a wild ride, I can promise you that. But then again, seeking truth in a sea of lies usually is. But that's what makes it so much fun. All right, so we're starting out with Lincoln's conception of the Union. When Lincoln took office, it's important to remember that the secession crisis was already underway by the time Lincoln was inaugurated. 7 states had seceded by the time he was inaugurated in March of 1861. Now, the other important thing to remember, though, is that this was restricted to the Deep South. The Confederate states had been established, and they had elected their first president, Jefferson Davis. But the Upper South, Virginia, North Carolina, and Tennessee, none of those states had seceded. In fact, at the time, they had thought about it. They had had conventions, and they decided, no, this is not in our interest. We do not want to secede. It was outright rejected in Virginia and North Carolina. So at that time, they had made up their own mind about secession and clearly thought it was not the right thing to do. So when Lincoln took office, he was convinced that there was this crisis to be solved. In Lincoln's opinion, secession was illegal unless every single state agreed to it. He called the USA an indissoluble union made up of one people, that is, one singular nation. And he wound up taking a pretty unpopular position of people like John Marshall and Joseph Story, who at the time argued that the nation, which was made up of states, is no different than a state which is made up of counties. So their argument is that, there's just no difference. You know, that Pennsylvania is a county of the United States and that Massachusetts is a county. You know, it's not a sovereign political body. It's just a political subdivision, a mere corporation of the nation. But there's a huge problem with this line of argument. See, it's true that the states do decide upon and create their counties, the counties that are within them. So the counties really can be thought of as just geographic subdivisions. There's no problem with that. That's the structure and function of the states. It always has been. But that's not true of the relationship between the general government, which is the United States. That's not true about the relationship between the general government and the states themselves. The states, it turns out, when you actually study the history, It turns out the states declared their independence as separate bodies. I want you to read the last line of the Declaration of Independence once more. If you haven't read it recently, it's a good thing to read every once in a while, but the very last line says everything you need to understand about the singular independence of each colony as a new state. And at the time, and still today, state means country, right? We talk about the French state, the British state. At the time, there was no difference. If someone said, "What is your homeland?" they wouldn't say the United States. They would say Virginia, or they would say Tennessee, or they would say North Carolina. So anyways, here's the last line of the Declaration of Independence. These united colonies are, and of right, ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain, see, there it is again, state of Great Britain, is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do, end quote. So there you have it. I mean, we almost don't need to go into it anymore. It's pretty clear. They have all the powers of any other independent state. But notice they're referred to in the plural. If what was being declared independent was one giant mass of people or one singular nation that had declared independence, wouldn't it have been written in the singular? No, of course not. It wasn't written that way, and it wasn't one nation. These were free, independent, sovereign nations declaring each's singular right of independence. And even after the Revolutionary War ended, the Treaty of Paris confirms this. So the peace treaty, which ended the Revolutionary War with Britain, recognized the state's individual independence, and they called each state out by name. Here's what it says in the Treaty of Paris. Quote, His Britannic Majesty acknowledges the said United States, New Hampshire, Massachusetts Bay, Rhode Island and Providence Plantations, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia to be free, sovereign, and independent states, and he treats with them as such, dot, dot, dot. So this is proof positive that the states, as independent, separate political bodies, preceded the union that we currently live in today, and the general government, which binds them together. Later, the states would propose and ratify a general government for the expressed and limited purposes set forth in a written constitution. And it is so painfully clear to me, and I think anyone else who studies the history, that these states were independent and sovereign, and that they, because they separately and independently agreed to the Confederation called the United States of America. Think about that. Each and every state ratified and joined the United States at different times, using different ratification debates and different ratification votes. There's just no sane pathway to arguing that the general government was created all at once by one indivisible body of the masses. It just didn't happen that way. The Constitution was created such that it could come into effect with just 9 of the 13 colonies ratifying it. So if the states were truly subservient to the general government at that time, if the Union preceded the states, then what would have happened to one of those states that chose not to ratify? Well, the truth is that any state outside of the first 9 who chose not to ratify would have been free to continue its existence as a free and independent state, because that's what it was all along. And yet Lincoln later, 150 years later, argues that the general government, the singular nation called the United States, was created by one singular unified people prior to the creation of the states. This is his argument later at the time of the Civil War. And that's complete and utter nonsense. There's no one who is sane who can make that argument. But as I read more about Lincoln, I come to find that maybe he was insane. Oh, no, I can't go that far. That's blasphemy. The worst part about this is that it's really only because of this misunderstanding that Lincoln can rationalize in his head that for a state to legally secede, they have to get the agreement of all the states. So right from the outset, Lincoln's reasoning is fatally flawed, and it leads him to misunderstand the very union that he was elected to serve as chief executive. And that misunderstanding turns out to be tragic because it would also lead him to wage one of the bloodiest and costliest wars in the history of our people. So that's what Lincoln thought of the Union. That's how incredibly and tragically wrong he was. But that's only the first piece of the puzzle. The next piece of the puzzle that we need to take a look at is Lincoln's primary political motivations, which I say are centralization and consolidation of political power. So let's get into that. Prior to becoming president, Lincoln spent about 28 years in politics. He didn't just magically become president while sitting humbly in a log cabin. He has a political record, and we can research it, and we can know what's in it, and we can learn a great deal about what he valued politically. During his time in politics, he spent a majority of his career advocating for and attempting to implement a system of economic central planning, which at the time was called the American system. Now, I want you to remember that term. It's really important. But the American system wasn't the brainchild of Lincoln himself. Quite to the contrary, this system of economic central planning had been around for centuries under various different names. For instance, during the time of the American Revolution and the writing and ratification of the current Constitution, a very similar system was being used in Great Britain and was being debated as to whether or not the United States should take up the same type of system. And at the time, it was called mercantilism. Not exactly the same, but pretty close. And this form of economic central planning was most famously advocated for by Alexander Hamilton during the early years of the Union. Hamilton loved mercantilism. He wanted to make America into, the North American version of the British mercantilist system. And so at this point, I think it's worth recalling that if you don't already know, that Alexander Hamilton supported such a strong national and centralized general government that during the Constitutional Convention, he proposed that the executive power in America would be vested in elected kings who would serve for life, who would have total veto power over any legislation passed by the states. In addition, Hamilton wanted the general government to have unlimited inferred powers. To say the least, Hamilton supported an incredibly strong central control over the new union. And that's important to remember because it sets the tone for what kind of government goes along with mercantilism and later the American system, the system that Lincoln sought after his entire career. As history clearly shows us, Hamilton was unable to implement that kind of system at the nation's founding. Instead, the Constitutional Convention yielded a wholly different type of union, one that was largely decentralized, with limited and enumerated powers granted to the general government, with the vast majority of powers being retained in the states and in the peoples of those states. Unfortunately, this would not be the death of mercantilism. Even though mercantilism was outright rejected, it didn't die. Years later, a man named Henry Clay would pick up the baton and rejuvenate the system in what he would call the American system. Now, it had a new name, but it was basically the same idea with the same planks. But luckily, Clay also had difficulty getting the American system to come to fruition and to be passed and implemented. And so this is where Abraham Lincoln enters the story. Lincoln was a staunch supporter of centralization of power through the American system. If Henry Clay was the emperor, Abraham Lincoln was Darth Vader. He believed wholeheartedly in the American system, and he would not rest until it became implemented. So during his political career, he continued to fight for it. But Lincoln, too, never quite got the American system to be adopted. And why was it, well, at least before he was president, I should say that. He never got it to be adopted before he was president. So why was it so hard to implement the American system? Well, in order to understand that, you have to first understand what are the three basic planks of the American system. So let's go through that. So the three planks, it's very basic. The three planks are, number one, protectionist tariffs. economic protectionism through high tariffs on foreign goods. Number two, taxpayer-funded government subsidies for internal improvements, which at the time meant the funding of railroad corporations. And today, we call that crony capitalism. So protectionist tariffs, crony capitalism, and the funding of all of this by the nationalization of the money supply through central banking. Now, those three items had all been hotly contested at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 and ever after. They were always being debated. Once again, the debate boiled down to this familiar question of how much power the general government had. Was the United States to be a union of largely centralized national power, or was it to be a confederation of sovereign states, each with its own system of domestic governance? Clearly, the convention of 1787 came away with the answer that the union was the latter. It was the confederation of decentralized sovereign states. And for this reason, Hamilton, Henry Clay, and Lincoln all had great difficulty implementing their system. President after president vetoed the attempt to implement the three planks of the American system. And so why were there so many vetoes? Well, because the Constitution stood squarely opposed to those ideas. The presidents who issued those vetoes knew, and some of them, by the way, wanted those planks to be implemented, but they knew that they couldn't in good conscience sign the applicable bills into law while upholding their oath to defend the Constitution. It would later become tragically apparent that a similar appeal to conscience would not easily dissuade the great consolidator Abraham Lincoln. So, now that you understand the American system, we need to ask ourselves, okay, Mike, you're making some pretty wild claims. Was he really obsessed with the American system? Well, don't take my word for it. Listen to Lincoln himself. When Lincoln ran for state legislature in 1832, this is what he told the voters. He said, quote, "Fellow citizens, I presume you all know who I am. I am humble Abraham Lincoln. I have been solicited by my many friends to become a candidate for the legislature. My politics are short and sweet like the old woman's dance. I am in favor of a national bank. I am in favor of internal improvement systems and a high protective tariff. These are my sentiments and political principles." End quote. That was it. That was the start of his political career, and this is how he introduces himself. So, as far as I know, that's the first political agenda that he ever outlined publicly, and it turns out that he would spend the rest of his career working on those three things. So we have to understand first and foremost that Lincoln's political ambitions revolved around a type of central governmental control that was in stark opposition to the type of government that was formed in 1787 and that had been rejected not only by the states at the convention, but by president after president after president. He wanted to change things. And if you want to, why don't we do it? Let's put it in slightly more modern words that I promise you'll recognize. Lincoln's ambition was to fundamentally transform the Union. He wanted to transform it from the decentralized confederation of sovereign independent states into a giant unitary national behemoth, and he wanted to use the American system to do it. There are no ifs, ands, or buts about this. There's just no arguing with this point. As you'll soon see, he was willing to stop at nothing to accomplish this goal. All right, so now that you understand the history and Lincoln's political motivations, and what he thought of the Union, only now can we truly tackle the issue of slavery. So we have to ask, did Lincoln wage the war to free the slaves? Remember at the beginning, I told you that one of the reasons people love Lincoln is because he supposedly fought a war to free the slaves, right? That's what the Civil War was about. It was about slavery. Well, first and foremost, let's just say, I'm not naive enough to say that the Civil War was not about slavery. Of course, slavery was a huge part, maybe the vast majority part of why the Civil War occurred. But it wasn't the entire story. And as is often the case, some of the finer points, some of the finer minutiae, the details that are often left out can really change the way that you look at the history and you understand how things happened the way they did. So let's spend some time talking about, you know, now that we know what did motivate Lincoln, let's spend some time talking about what most certainly did not motivate him in waging war, and that would be slavery. So the notion that Lincoln was politically motivated by the emancipation of the slaves is, again, part of the Lincoln myth. It's a complete fabrication. It is not based in any sort of truth. According to Roy Basler, the editor of Lincoln's collected works, Lincoln barely ever mentioned the issue of slavery prior to 1854. And the truth is that at the outset of the war between the states, Lincoln never intended to abolish slavery. To the contrary, he stated many times that he, quote, acknowledged the rights of slave owners to own their slaves, not grudgingly, but fully and fairly, end quote. And furthermore, he would declare that he would give slave owners whatever legislation that they wanted for the claiming of their fugitives. It's quite clear to me that Lincoln was not the man that history has made him out to be. He was not a man on a mission to free the slaves. As we've already discovered, he was truly obsessed, and indeed his political mission was the centralization of power through Henry Clay's American system, or Hamilton's mercantilism. Those were his motives. And to shock your sensibilities a little bit further, I'm going to push you to the brink now. Those were the ambitions over which he was willing to wage total war against his own people. He was not willing to wage war on his people to end slavery, but he was willing to wage war on his own people to achieve the mercantilist system or the American system. And if you doubt me, because I know a lot of people are, and that's fine, I'd actually be shocked if you didn't doubt me, because this flies in the face of everything you've learned your entire life. But again, don't take my word for it. Let's let Mr. Lincoln himself tell us why he would and wouldn't consider waging war on his own people. So let's take a look at his first inaugural address. It starts out, he says, quote, I have no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery where it exists. I believe I have no lawful right to do so, and I have no inclination to do so. Later on in the address, it says, there needs to be no bloodshed or violence, and there shall be none, unless it be forced upon the national authority. The power confided to me will be used to hold, occupy, and possess the property and places belonging to the government, and to collect the duties and imposts. But beyond what may be necessary for these objects, there will be no invasion, no use of force against or among the people anywhere. Shall we unpack that? What he says here in his inaugural address is that he will absolutely not interfere with slavery. This is not a motivation for him. But he will use bloodshed and violence and invasion and other uses of force in order to occupy and possess property and in order to collect duties and imposts. Those are taxes. So this is shocking. This is his first inaugural address. In his first address to the Union, does he summon a language of peace and filial attachment to the peoples of the Union? Does he take the opportunity to use a tone of conciliatory compromise? No, nothing doing. He brutishly declares that he will invade and occupy his own people if they refuse to pay the proper royalties. But free the slaves? Nah, no need for war for that silly thing. So please, let us dispense with the kindergarten nonsense which most Americans still cling to. Now, you may very well like the outcome of Lincoln's time in office. Fine, that's fair. I have no problem with you if you say, well, the ends justify the means. Slavery was abolished, so Lincoln is the best. At least you're being honest. Now, I don't agree with you that the ends justify the means, but at least you're not portraying yourself as a cartoon. So can we finally put to bed this notion that Lincoln fought a war to free the slaves? There's just no historical backing for that kind of claim. And it's at this point that I get questions about the Emancipation Proclamation. I say, whoa, hold on a second. Didn't he do the Emancipation Proclamation and that freed the slaves, didn't it? Could it be said that Lincoln was secretly motivated by the abolition of slavery all along, but he only brought out the Emancipation Proclamation as a weapon when he believed it would be the most useful? Yeah, I've heard that. And again, this is just a fanciful adoration of the deity. People have been so brainwashed by the supposed perfection of Lincoln that they cling to whatever cockeyed notion allows them to keep him in their good graces. Unfortunately, there's no truth in the idea that Lincoln was secretly saving emancipation for the right time. And I know this because I understand why Lincoln used the proclamation in the first place. It had nothing to do with freeing human beings from bondage, and it had everything to do with using slaves as his war pawns. See, in a letter to his Treasury Secretary, Salmon Chase, Lincoln admitted, he said, quote, "The original proclamation has no legal justification except as a military measure." And Secretary of State at the time, William Seward, rightly pointed out, he says, quote, "We show our sympathy of slavery by emancipating slaves where we cannot reach them and holding them in bondage where we can set them free." What does he mean by that? Well, it turns out that the Emancipation Proclamation was never meant to free anyone. It had no effect on slaves who were still in bondage in the slave states that were still in the Union. So even in the Union where, although it's unconstitutional, let's say they just decided to free everyone all over the Union. That might actually, I might actually go along with that. I mean, slavery is abhorrent and terrible. I might be okay with Lincoln if he said, look, we're just done with this. We're just doing it. Sorry, you can't own people. It's not right. It's immoral. Can't do it. But he didn't do that. He said only in areas that were in rebellion were the slaves freed. Well, what that meant was there were a few slave states that were still in the Union. Were those slaves freed? Nope, not a single one of them. And in the Confederacy, the rebellious states, the proclamation had no effect because no Union law had effect in the Confederacy. So, it's in this way that Lincoln was using the slaves as his war pawns. Now, you have to first understand that at the time of the proclamation, Lincoln and the North were losing the war, and they were losing badly. So the Emancipation Proclamation, in his own words, was little more than a military measure. And in fact, the military measure, which, by the way, was pretty smart. I mean, look, I don't like Lincoln, but he was a smart guy. It had two primary aims of the proclamation. First, Lincoln hoped that the word of the Emancipation Proclamation would reach the slaves in the South and encourage them to rise up and wage an insurrection against his enemy, the Confederacy. Second, Lincoln knew that outside nations who had abolished slavery would not want to ally with either side if it still supported slavery. So the North had stated its intention to abolish slavery in the South. Maybe the foreign nations would ally with the North accordingly. So that's what he was doing. It was all about a military strategy, and it had, you know, it had no intention to free slaves. It freed precisely zero slaves, but it was meant to spark an insurrection and to entice allies to join their cause. Again, the slaves were just being used. Now, to me, that doesn't sound like the actions of a man obsessed with abolition. To me, that sounds like the actions of a man obsessed with winning a war and with proving that secession, self-government, and state sovereignty were never again to be respected in the Americas. It was all about winning the war and proving that the states could not secede. So, another question I get having to do with slavery is, okay, well, even if you admit that he didn't intend to free the slaves, I mean, but he was all about racial equality, right? Didn't he believe in racial equality? No. The answer is no on that. Sorry to burst your bubble. Now, there are quite a few examples of great pragmatic men who held the attitude that slavery should be abolished because it should be abolished, but they couldn't do it because it wasn't practical at the time. A great example of that is Thomas Jefferson, who during his time admitted many, many times that slavery was abhorrent and should be abolished. According to the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, they say throughout his entire life, Jefferson was a consistent opponent of slavery. He called it a moral depravity and a hideous blot. He believed that slavery presented the greatest threat to the survival of the new American nation. He also thought that slavery was contrary to the laws of nature, which decreed that everyone had a right to personal liberty. These views were radical in a world where unfree labor was the norm, and at the time of the American Revolution, Jefferson was actively involved in legislation that he hoped would result in slavery's abolition. In 1778, he drafted a Virginia law that prohibited the importation of enslaved Africans. And in 1784, he proposed an ordinance that would ban slavery in the Northwest Territories. But Jefferson also always maintained that the decision to emancipate would have to be part of a democratic process. So, again, not excusing the fact that Jefferson owned slaves, right? There's no excuse for that. But at least he falls into that category of men where we can say, look, he was against it. He was trying to, you know, slowly bring people around. You know, it was a tough thing to do. So can we put Lincoln in the ranks of people who felt similarly to Jefferson and many others? Well, like I said, it turns out the answer to that question is decidedly no. In fact, Lincoln stated many times that he was opposed to the idea of racial equality at all. In 1858, in a debate with Stephen Douglas, Lincoln said, quote, "I have no purpose to introduce political and social equality between the white and black races. There is a physical difference between the two, which, in my judgment, will probably forever forbid their living together upon the footing of perfect equality. And inasmuch as it becomes a necessity that there must be a difference, I, as well as Judge Douglas, am in favor of the race to which I belong having the superior position. I have never said anything to the contrary." End quote. In addition to that, Lincoln was always opposed to blacks serving as elected officials or jurors or obtaining the right to vote. He also opposed interracial marriage, wanted the government to ban interracial marriage, which of course it did for a very long time. And when Stephen Douglas tried to claim that Lincoln favored racial equality, he was aghast. He was insulted. Lincoln responded. He said, "Anything that argues me into his idea of perfect social and political equality with the Negro is but a specious and fantastic arrangement of words by which a man can prove a horse chestnut to be a chestnut horse." Interestingly enough, prior to the Emancipation Proclamation, when it came to the subject of emancipation of the slaves, Lincoln was on record stating, quote, "Free them and make them politically and socially our equals? My own feelings will not admit of this. We cannot then make them equals." See, again, we have to keep going back to things we've already covered because it's important to review them and reiterate. Remember what we've discussed. He strongly supported the right of slave owners to own slaves as property. When referring to slave owners who had made such an assertion of their property ownership over human beings, Lincoln said, "When they remind us of their constitutional rights to own slaves, I acknowledge them, not grudgingly, but fully and fairly, and I would give them any legislation for reclaiming their fugitives." Okay, so what's the point here on racial equality? Well, to me, the main point is that Lincoln simply wasn't this angelic figure that he's been made out to be. Certainly, there are plenty of instances of Lincoln using language that would make it seem like he was a progressive in regards to the rights of slaves and the black race. You know, in contrast to what I've already covered, Lincoln publicly called slavery a monstrous injustice, and he would frequently defend the natural rights of all races to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. So why would Lincoln engage in such blatant doublespeak? Why would he endorse natural rights of all races? Why would he call slavery an injustice and then turn right around and proclaim that he had no intention of doing anything about slavery and that he had no power to do it and say that we're not equal? I mean, why the doublespeak? Well, what we need to understand is that in the context of the time, it was highly unlikely that anyone who wanted to be elected to a national political office, it's unlikely that they would support full and immediate emancipation. So what was Lincoln to do? Well, one thing you have to remember is that Lincoln was a politician. Yes, he was a lawyer, but he was a politician, and he was a darn good one. So he knew how to do what every politician has always done. He tells you the story you want to hear in order to gain your vote. To me, this is simply more proof that Lincoln's core motivation was not the abolition of slavery and it was not racial equality, but that his motivation was to achieve national political power with the ultimate goal of implementing his long-sought-after American system with its focus on consolidation of power over the entire continent. But since the vast majority of people nowadays suffer from the Lincoln myth syndrome, it's really unlikely that you've ever been presented with this picture of Lincoln. And so that brings us to our final topic, which is Lincoln's real legacy. So what is Abraham Lincoln's true legacy? What do we deal with today? Well, we've learned that for his entire career, he was obsessed with the fundamental transformation of the American Union. He was convinced that the path to prosperity would be found in the centralization of power and the reduction of the states to mere political counties with no real sovereignty. Yeah, good call, Abe. Yeah, never before has centralization of power done anything horrible. See Lenin, see Stalin, see Hitler, see Pol Pot. Yeah, good job, Lincoln. But history shows us that president after president, even those who wanted to implement that system, they had no choice but to veto the legislation in favor of it because the Constitution stood opposed to it. But what if the country was at war? And not just any war, but a civil war fought against rebellious, traitorous, treasonous slime balls. Do you think, based on what we know about what war does to a people and what war does to the curtailment of civil liberties during that time, do you think that such a war might give the chief executive just a little more power and a little more ability to implement those political policies that might otherwise not be possible in a union of limited power? Yeah, in fact, I think history tells us that this is precisely how limited governments are most easily turned into all-powerful governments. It's just when the government convinces you that you're in danger and that your very existence and way of life are threatened that you are willing to turn a blind eye to the death of your liberties and nonchalantly surrender your responsibility to govern yourself and to protect yourself and give it all up to the watchful and benevolent state. That's when it happens. And this is exactly how Lincoln finally achieved the American system, which was his, you know, which is the legacy we live with today. In fact, during Lincoln's first 2 years in office, after nearly a century of past presidents' vetoes, it only took Lincoln 2 years to find a way to implement every single plank of the American system. Do you think maybe the war helped along the effort? The question answers itself. So how does this affect us today? Well, let's take a detailed look at it. What are some of the evils we live with today whose roots took form during Lincoln's time in office and during the bloody war? Well, first, high protectionist tariffs. Prior to the war in 1857, tariffs were on the decline. They were down to historic lows, averaging around 24% for imports. And many raw materials were completely tariff-free. And countries all over Europe were doing away with tariffs altogether, and it was likely that the U.S. probably would have followed suit in order to remain competitive. But after the war started, by 1862, because of the war, that average tariff rate was now up to 47%. That was a rate that had never before been achieved in the nation's history. I mean, you gotta fund a war, right? So, well, everybody better pay up. Today, we live with this notion that protectionist tariffs do something other than make goods more expensive and inhibit free trade. And let me just tell you, the Lincoln myth is in full swing with good old Donnie Trump. In his first speech to a joint session of Congress, Donald Trump invoked Lincoln just like I told you he would, just like I knew he would, and just like every single politician. Until the day I die, they'll all be invoking Lincoln. This is what we live with. See, Trump shows us that he's afflicted by Lincoln myth syndrome when the other night in the first speech to a joint session, he said, quote, "I believe strongly in free trade, but it also has to be fair trade." That means you don't believe in free trade. "It has been a long time since we had fair trade. The first Republican president, Abraham Lincoln, warned that the abandonment of the protective policy by the American government will produce want and ruin among our people. Lincoln was right, and it's time we heeded his advice and his words." Of course, as is the case with Donald Trump, he offers no proof that Lincoln was right. But it's the Lincoln myth syndrome, so I guess we just have to believe him, right? Well, Lincoln did it, and you once you've been liberated from LMS, Lincoln myth syndrome, you're going to find yourself catching this stuff all over the place. Everybody invokes Lincoln. Well, Lincoln did it, so it's got to be great, right? That's how we found ourselves in the predicament we're in today, folks. That's why we're having this last section of the podcast. What do we live with? It all goes back to Lincoln. All right, so high protectionist tariffs are number one. Number two, internal improvements. Folks, I want you to always and forever understand that internal improvements is synonymous with crony capitalism. Prior to Lincoln taking office, every state in the Union had a provision in the state constitution which forbade the use of tax dollars for internal improvement subsidies. Prior to 1860, no federal bill for internal improvement subsidies had ever passed both houses and been signed into law. Too many representatives, senators, and presidents understood that it was blatantly unconstitutional. But Lincoln didn't care about the constitutionality of those subsidies. So, you know, even though Lincoln was losing the war in the early 1860s and losing badly, he and the Republican Congress found a way to divert millions of taxpayer dollars to build a railroad in California. With the Southern representatives no longer an obstacle to this happening, the second plank of the American system, the Congress and the president had no trouble putting it into place, and thus federal subsidies for large connected corporations were born. And we've dealt with this kind of crony capitalism ever since. So the next time you hear some big R Republican complaining and whining to you that government shouldn't be picking winners and losers, you know, and they talk about Solyndra and what a bad idea that was, please kindly remind them that their savior Lincoln can be thanked for that precedent. In fact, some of the ramifications of Lincoln's unwise venture into crony capitalism impact us today in ways that aren't quite so immediately apparent. See, it turns out that once the federal government got into the business of subsidizing big businesses, which again all started with Lincoln's precious railroads, the beginnings of the modern day regulatory state were born. Yeah, I know, right? I didn't realize that either. I just learned this. So because the government meddled in the affairs of the free market with the subsidization of railroads in the 1860s, that turned into an overabundance of railroads. And so the overbuilt transportation system caused a lot of economic problems. And those problems in turn gave birth to, well, what does the state do when there's a problem? It blames the free market and invents a bureaucracy. So the Interstate Commerce Commission was created to help with the overbuilt transportation system. And the commission, of course, was supposed to fix things, but of course, it simply made things worse. So what did they do? They blamed the free market, and the snowball effect began. And you can trace things like Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank, which we deal with today, you can trace their roots all the way back to Abe Lincoln and his internal improvements. Thanks, Abe. All right, so the third thing that we live under, the third biggie that we live under, is the central bank. So in 1861, there was no central bank. There had been previously, but it was done away with. It was always argued that a central bank was unconstitutional. It got pushed through for a while, and then it expired, and nobody wanted to bring it back. So at the time, the monetary system consisted solely of state-chartered banknotes, which were redeemable for gold or silver coins. They were backed by gold and silver. This was hard, stable money. There was no way the general government could devalue your money by printing more and more of it. There had to be gold or silver behind it. So your money retained its value quite well in the 1850s and up till 1861. Now, no monetary system is perfect, right? That you have to understand that. But history shows us that that type of system, backed by hard money, is one of the best ones the U.S. ever had, one of the most stable monetary systems the U.S. ever had. But in 1862, Lincoln began to implement the third and final plank of the American system that he had always lusted for. He signed into law the Legal Tender Act, which empowered the federal treasury to issue paper money printed with green ink. And of course, this is where we get the term greenbacks. So over the next 2 years, subsequent currency acts would be passed that would create a nationally chartered government-controlled central bank, which could issue as many banknotes as it wanted, thus the birth of massive inflation. So in the first year alone, the amount of greenbacks more than doubled, which lowered the value of each piece of paper to only about 35% of its original worth, and thus was born the practice of financing the nation's debt via inflation, or in other words, a giant hidden tax on the American citizen. So those are just three things. There's many, many more. Those are just three things, but they all trace their roots back to Lincoln. In fact, you know what? I'm going to give you one more. I want to give you one more because this is one. It's March now, and it's just about to be tax season. So why don't I give you a bonus Lincoln legacy? I'm in a good mood, and it's been 3 weeks since we've spoken. So here's another one. Here's a bonus: the income tax. Although the income tax is not technically part of the American system, I want to make sure you understand that Lincoln, the generous man that he was, decided to throw you a bonus in the form of the nation's very first income tax. Yep, that's right. Every time you think about the income tax and how much you hate it, just remember the very first income tax in America was signed into law by Abraham Lincoln. And although later the tax would die due to its unconstitutionality, that law's success in raising money and whetting the appetite of bureaucrats all over the nation, as soon as they saw how much money they could ring in with that, you gotta know that that was what was used later to lobby for and help pass the amendment, which would re-enable the federal government to rob you on a weekly basis. So once again, thanks, Abe. So those are some of the horribly negative ramifications that we live with today because of good old Abe Lincoln. But I also want to talk to you about what I consider to be probably the worst of everything Lincoln gave us, everything he left in his destructive wake. I think the worst was his fundamental transformation of the structure and function of the government of these United States. Prior to the war between the states, the United States, as we've discussed, was highly decentralized. It was a confederation, and there were sovereign individual states. But after the war, there is no question the United States had been forever transformed into a centralized, consolidated national government, with little powers left in the realm of the once sovereign states. You know, so when Lincoln, or when anyone else for that matter, argued that the war was waged to save the Union, nothing further from the truth could be said, because the Union prior to the war was a voluntary association of sovereign states banded together for some common goals. Alexis de Tocqueville observed in his Democracy in America, he said, "The Union was formed by the voluntary agreement of the states. In uniting together, they have not forfeited their nationality, nor have they been reduced to the condition of one and the same people. If one of the states chooses to withdraw from the compact, it would be difficult to disapprove its right of doing so, and the federal government would have no means of maintaining its claim directly, either by force or of right." But you see, after the Civil War was over, it's quite clear that that peaceful association of sovereign states, that was dead and gone. And what replaced it was a coercive, vengeful marriage of unwilling parties. So in reality, Lincoln waged war with the intention to implement a centralized economic system, but wound up proving once and for all that states could not secede, they could not govern themselves, and they were not independent and sovereign. How could anyone argue that the Union, which was invented in 1787 and implemented in 1789, was anything but destroyed by this war? What remained in 1865 looked nothing like what had been given to us in 1787. The Union of our founders was most certainly dead, and on its ashes stood a new, centralized, all-powerful nation. What an insult to the founders to say that Lincoln saved the Union. All right, one final topic before I'm done. I feel it's my obligation to just give a quick reminder about libertarianism. So before we're all done, I want to take a moment and remind everyone that as a libertarian, slavery is probably the second most ghastly affront to freedom that is imaginable, second only to murder, but not by much. See, the fact that slavery was abolished is unquestionably a good thing. Of course, it never should have existed in the first place. Now, the fascinating history, though, again, something that you'll never read in a standard mainstream textbook, the fascinating thing to me is that almost every single society that abolished slavery in the 19th century, and there were many of them, they did so peacefully. So the question, then, isn't whether or not slavery should have been abolished. I mean, the answer to that question is so ridiculously obvious, it almost doesn't need to be given. But for the sake of posterity, I'll say it. Yes, slavery should have been abolished, and yes, it should have been as soon as possible, and yes, it never should have existed in the first place. Okay? We got that out of the way? Are we good? All right. No, to me, the real question, then, is what was the best way for abolition to come about? Was the best way for abolition to come about a dictatorial president to wage war on innocent men, women, and children? And he did do that, killing over about 600,000 people. Was the best way to destroy entire cities and communities? Was the best way to violate the Constitution on dozens of levels? Was the best way to silence dissenters by jailing them? Was the best way to deport American citizens who are critical of the administration? Was the best way to suspend habeas corpus in the non-rebellious areas of the Union? Was the best way to annihilate a peaceful and voluntary confederation of sovereign peoples and replace it with a system of coercive and subjugated national control? Or would peaceful emancipation have been preferable? I guess we'll never know. But please, it's certainly not evil to wonder what could have been had peaceful emancipation been more thoughtfully and thoroughly explored. It worked in many, many other places in the 19th century. I think it could have worked for us. All right, so how do you feel? I know, that was a lot. This is a long one. And, you know, what's amazing to me is that I've only barely scratched the surface. I've gone through what I believe to be the most important bits of information that I could cram into a roughly 1 hour podcast. But there's so much more you can learn. So before we close, I absolutely must recommend to you the terrific works of Tom DiLorenzo, which have inspired me to rid myself of the Lincoln myth syndrome forever. What about you? Has this podcast been the antidote to your Lincoln myth syndrome? I'd really love to hear from you. Do you disagree with me? Do you think I've gone off my rocker? Am I a racist, slavery-supporting neo-Confederate? Send me an email at mike@battleforliberty.com. Get the discussion started. Get in touch via Twitter at @mybattleliberty. If you're looking for a way to help me out with this show, there's one thing you can do for me that not a lot of people are doing right now, so I'd love it if you would go onto iTunes and give a positive review. Look up the podcast in iTunes and leave a good review. That will really help me out. Also, as always, make sure you're subscribed to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and refer that friend. Make sure you're subscribed to my email list. I want you to subscribe on iTunes, on Stitcher, and my email list. That way, when Facebook and Twitter decide that I'm a racist neo-Confederate and they ban me forever, you'll still be able to hear from me on a regular basis. So like the Facebook page while it still exists, follow me on Twitter while that still exists, and go on over to Gab and look us up at Battle for Liberty on Gab. So please, if you know someone who's suffering from Lincoln myth syndrome, I guarantee they have an hour of their time they can give to you that they can give to this show. Who knows? What's the worst that can happen? Maybe they say, "Ugh, I can't believe you listen to this idiot." And you go, "Oh no, I don't listen to him that often." But I know you have someone who needs to hear this. So do me that favor, spread the word about the Battle for Liberty. And until next time, battle on.